You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 523. So much of great American drama has been about a certain kind of dysfunctional family, and maybe my interests are in the kind of strange dysfunction that exists even among deeply functional families. Stephen Karam.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Hey guys, before we get started, I want to let you know that we are having our annual Black Friday sale at Indie Film Hustle Academy and Indie Film Hustle TV. If you are interested in learning more about screenwriting and filmmaking, film distribution, learning screenwriting and character development from instructors like James V. Hart, the writer of Hook and Dracula, learning film distribution from me with my course, The Film Distribution Blueprint, learning how to produce an independent film from veteran producer Suzanne Lyons, how to pitch investors the indie film funding formula, and so much more. So head over to ifhacademy.com and use the coupon code BLACKFRIDAY2021. And you can also go to indiefilmhustle.tv and use the same coupon code BLACKFRIDAY2021 to get 30% off the annual subscription. Now, this sale is only going to be going on until November 30th, so act quickly. Again, ifhacademy.com and indiefilmhustle.tv, coupon code BLACKFRIDAY2021 for 30% off everything. Well, guys, today on the show, we have Tony Award-winning writer-director and Pulitzer nominee, Stephen Karam. And we're here to talk about his new film, The Humans, which is being released by A24. Now, Stephen has been writing for a while. He's written a few other screenplays for features, and this movie is based on one of his award-winning plays. And it is a really interesting exploration of the human experience, to say the least. And we get into it in this one without question. It was a ball talking to Stephen. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Stephen Karam. I'd like to welcome the show, Stephen Karam. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing today?
I'm good, brother.
It's Karam.
It is Karam, but it's Karam in the motherland.
It is.
So I was trying to be authentic.
You actually nailed it. You nailed it. No, I'm doing great. I'm excited to be here and be on the show.
I appreciate that, man. Listen, I just got done watching your film literally 10 minutes ago. Cause I wanted to be as fresh as humanly possible. And I absolutely loved it. And we're going to get deep into, the humans and how you came up with it and all that stuff. But first things first, how did you get started in the business?
Good question. I fell in love with storytelling in Scranton, Pennsylvania, not through any formal education, or I my sister was in a production of Little Shop of Horrors at East Scranton Intermediate School. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing the movie and kind of just being blown away and wanting to get as many VHS tapes as I could. So it started just as an interest, public library, how many videos can I take out? How many plays can I read? And because what was going on in my high school were, you know, student theater, I started imitating whatever playwrights, you know, I'd be reading in Scranton High School, whatever we were doing. So my first like memory of like creating stuff and participating was both acting in school plays and then trying to imitate writers that I loved. So just writing sketches, in eighth grade, I made a film version of The Cask of Amontillado for a school project.
Nice.
With three of my classmates. I didn't know how to, I had no editing equipment. So I had to, using the crazy heavy camcorder, I had to film it. The only way I could figure out how to do it was to film everything on the tape in order. And so it's like, if I didn't get something right, you had to just go back.
And then try not to eat into the previous take.
So that was technically my first. That was like my first like stab at directing. But you're laughing. Do you have any similar experience?
I've been directing for 25 years, my friend, and I lived in a video store. I actually worked in a video store in my high school days. So my editing in college, before college, was two VHS tapes, two VHS decks, and I just would crash. So I was just a step ahead of you.
That's a huge step. You were like my hero.
But the first ones, though, the first very first things I did in high school, because there was no technology, was exactly your technique. I didn't know how to edit. I didn't know what editing was. I didn't even understand the concepts because there was no information about. I mean, the only information I had was the making of Raiders of the Lost Ark VHS and the making of Star Wars VHS. And that was essentially all the film education I had at the time. Not so much on the editing. So I just kind of just like, well, if I shoot it in order, and you would see, and I actually watched it the other day. I don't know why I pulled out my old Hi-8 tapes, and I would see where the splices would come in because I could hit the record button. And if you don't hit pause, it would be like a janky cut. Oh, it's just horrible.
The janky cut. You get the splice. You know, you have to run with it. But it was there was a moment where the splice was so bad. I remember we added like I couldn't figure out how to bridge it, and so we added a commercial so that it would seem like the staticky splice was like zooping us into like a sponsor.
Oh, so you were doing like crazy transitions even in camera.
No, it was I remember the special effects. I remember was like I didn't learn how to. There was like a fade button, and so there was a great sequence where, if you know that short story, he's. It is a horror story, and it's basically that he ends up, these friends end up like one, he ends up burying the other alive, like walling him up brick by brick. Mm. And my sister's like play set, like play kitchen house had like, there was one section of it was brick exterior. So I kept like gently fading with this trowel, like using my dad's like trowel. And then we'd like fade back in, and just the like cardboard bricks would be a little higher. With the trowel, and then we fade out.
That's amazing.
And then we fade back in.
But you know, but the struggle was. But
this is
the struggle was real. The struggle was real.
And it's also just. I guess the short answer to your question is that this was not my entryway into making plays and films. Was not the sophisticated route. It was sort of. I was at a public school. There were no artists in my family, so I had wonderful arts educators here and there, and that sparked the love. But I was like a. Probably later than a lot of, when I think of what just incredible access young people and film students now have, both technology-wise. And it's just, I'm giddy. Like when I met people outside of the Paramount last night and just talking to students who, you know, at that time I was like, you know, talking about, well, I still don't have the money to buy anything else. And I don't know how to, I can't make any more movies on my parents' recorder because it takes too long to edit it. Now you're just talking to kids where it's like, it's just incredible. Like the technology is there. And if it's not there, it's in their hands on their phone. And so they already know and are able to do so much. It's really just completely thrilling. I don't want to get too far ahead of me, but I felt like the recall to these early experiences was in pre-production, like using my iPhone and Artemis Pro on my phone to just go and line up those opening sky shots of the opening credits. And just not taking any of that for granted. It's like, I can't imagine being born into that technology, because doing it was just such a sense of wonder, just sharing that with my cinematographer, like the back and forth. And I like to be able to map out something in a way that feels pretty sophisticated, especially once you figure out like what the my old ass iPhone is, like an iPhone 8S, whatever, you know. I think the focal length, it approximates like 18 millimeter, but you know, like I did have a lot of recall to like, how incredible is this that I can be having these discussions, like, and I remember just not being able to figure out how to do anything other than making the movie perfectly in order.
No, and but you learn, though. I mean, doing that's the thing. I think a lot of times filmmakers nowadays, and even writers, they don't. When you're doing, like, I sound like two old farts, but like when you do the struggle, like when you're struggling through that kind of technology, you're forced to learn things that you might not if you have everything at your disposal. So even if you're using your iPhone, there's still, you know, it's a lot different than shooting with an Arri or a Red, you know. And if you're editing on your iPhone or editing on, you know, Final Cut or DaVinci or Premiere, you're learning things. And you're right. I can't even comprehend what I would have done with the technology.
In some ways, I guess it's like everybody makes the most out of what,
yeah,
the pros and cons of where, of what, you know. And to your point, I think it's interesting. Like, I think about my being unafraid of like starting from not being seduced by the technology. Like, I feel like I wonder if I would be so seduced by, if I came of age in a time when I knew how, like, just maximizing the amount of like coverage you get, especially like over the shoulder, then we'll go in close, then we'll get the established. If I was like really married to how, cause I would have been an obsessive editor as a kid. I imagine I might've just been so attuned to that I would have abandoned, shots that might've, required a little more thought, like lost out on the joy of that. And when you start by being like, the only way to do it is to like rehearse and get things ready, suddenly like the idea of doing like a 2-minute shot where you have to like coordinate six actors, like it's so much of the way The Humans is filmed. It's like, I sort of love that. I feel like you end up, your weaknesses become your strengths because you sort of have both in your arsenal. Like, I'm so in awe of how a movie, you know, with a lot of coverage could be taken away from a director and made into a different movie by someone in post.
Oh yeah.
That I feel like my focus, I'm grateful that I also like know the benefits of what, even on a, when movies have to move so quickly, like just the benefit of what you can get from, if there's a reason for it, for like a longer take, or what that, the emotional resonance, the payoff of those moments can be.
Right.
Because I could see myself just being like, oh my God, just literally cover everything from every angle so that, you know, I could make this movie, you know, into it doesn't even have to be about a family if I decide to add enough voiceover in post.
Now, when you start your writing process, how do you approach the process in general? Do you go with characters first, plot first? You know, how do you actually approach the process in your world?
It's a little different every time. It ends up being centered around the characters. But in this case, the initial impulse was like, I was feeling a lot of fear and anxiety about, you know, I was at my day job, just about life in general. Financial crisis had just hit. I was an assistant at a law firm. I was thinking about writing my next play. I always like to write from fear or questions I can't answer. So I guess that's not character. But in that realm, I was thinking like, well, why? I guess I should be, a lot of things are keeping me up, and I should maybe, what would it mean if I decided to write about these questions I can't answer or these fears I'm having? Money, anxieties, worries about health and health insurance. And it all feels so mundane. And I've always loved the psychological thrillers, horror genre. I've always loved being scared. I was always the person that wanted to go on the haunted mansion ride or the haunted house. And I just thought, I've never written anything genre, but I was like, what if I write a play about people I love or the things that are keeping me and people I know up at night? And it's actually like somehow the story itself is like actually scary, but like viscerally scary. And so I was like, that, I think I might like to see that. And it might keep my interest, might. So I thought I was going to do something away from character, super genre, almost like a slasher movie, like where I would put a family in a haunted house and watch ghosts jump out of closets. And I still want to see that movie, and maybe I will see that movie, and those movies exist. But I just, when I put the people into the house, I started to really love them. They got more and more complex, and that kind of like 3, 4, 17 layers deep kind of layers of character doesn't necessarily lend itself. It sort of almost takes it out of being pure genre, even if you're trying to make it pure genre. So that was the origin of the humans on stage, as sort of, it went from being what I thought was going to be more of a camp stage thriller, like Death Trap, like a throwback to these, like Sleuth,
yeah,
one of those old commercial Broadway hits that didn't really exist anymore. And it just kind of, in spite of myself, I ended up with a bit of a genre collision, with something that really was a family drama comedy, but also completely infected by my love of the horror genre.
Oh, there's no question that the horror genre is like drizzled all over the place. Because I'm watching, and there's certain scenes in the movie as I'm watching, and I'm going, is there, I mean, am I safe? I mean, I walked in with this movie. I felt like I was watching this movie. Then all of a sudden, I was like, he's not gonna. There's no monster. There can't be a monster. But it was just so brilliantly done that at any moment, like you got me on edge. And I'm like, no, yeah. I trust the director. He's taking me this. I trust the storyteller. I can't believe, like, you know, an hour and something in, they're going to show the monster. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And the monster wasn't in the trailer. So that I.
Well, what's crazy is as somebody who loves more genre, but also loves like stuff that's subtle and skirts around the edges, it's like I, you know, you're always like create. I think it's like I always talk to my students. It's like you make the movie that feels like the only one you can make. And part of that is writing towards what you want to see and what you love and what scares you, what excites you. And I love movies, even when there are like literal ghosts, but I'm always disappointed. Always. And with few exceptions, like even a movie that I'm obsessed with, like Rosemary's Baby, you know, early Polanski, Repulsion, of course, all these great movies. But Rosemary's Baby, my least favorite part, or part that I think is the least scary, is when you see the demon baby.
Right, of course.
You get the peek into the crib. And I don't even want to call it a misfire, because when a movie's that brilliant, you don't need to fix anything. It is exactly what it should be. But it is funny that like that impulse, even in movies that I hold up as like, you know, like pinnacles of the genre, it is funny that I'm always like, just as a personal like clocking where I feel like a little less scared, or like, oh, my imagination was going to such a more interesting place than that demon, that little like the puppet baby with the makeup and the.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you don't want to see the shark. So, you don't want to see the shark in Jaws.
Yeah, but if you watch the end of The Humans again, I promise you, you will see something that will shock you, that you're going to be shocked that it's hidden in there so explicitly and that you didn't see it.
Okay.
It helps when you see it big, because did you see it on a movie screen?
No, I couldn't make it to the screening last night. So I saw it on a
just
small
to screen. Say that there is something, there is an effect of a potential, I don't want to say a faceless entity coming out of a wall in a way that, on a rewind or on a.
Oh, no, I saw. Like, I saw the thing that scared him.
Saw the thing that scared him at the end?
Most yeah. I saw that completely. Yeah, when he drops his. I don't want to give away too much.
We shouldn't do spoiler. Okay.
Like, so let's not go too deep into it, because I don't want to spoil it for people. But
I'm curious, because we both love Kubrick. I can see Stanley's hovering above you, but like, I'm curious, like, even in those movies, like, how do you. It is a fun push and pull, and it's. I kind of love that you were thinking. I guess my big joy with this movie is that the potential feels really real in a way that maybe it didn't quite as much on stage, but where you actually are like, is she actually? actually going to open a closet door? Like, is something really crazy going to jump out, or is this, you know, tension coming from?
So this is what I loved about the movie, man. You know, because when you first start watching it, I walked in cold. I didn't know the story. I only saw a trailer. I walked in cold. So that's the way, it's best way I would love watching movies. Just like, I don't want to know anything about it. Just do what you're supposed to do.
Did you turn the lights out? Did you turn the lights out?
Yeah, everything was dark. Yeah, everything was dark. Right,
okay.
Anyway. Yeah, of course. I mean, I have to watch a movie in the dark. So I'm watching it. And as I'm watching it, and the way the camera moves, which is so brilliant because you do a lot of frames within a frame in the film. I noticed that right away. There's just so much framing within framing and in framing. And the camera moves, I wouldn't say fly on the wall, but it's definitely distant. So you feel like you're voyeuristic in the entire – this is just my feeling on it. You're voyeuristic and you're overhearing something that you might not really should be overhearing. This is pretty private stuff. So I love that aspect. But then the noises and the booms, and then how you build that tension – which is so fascinating because I'm like, but this is not a horror movie. And this is not a thriller, I think. And that was the thing that I loved about it, because it kept me, someone who's seen 1,000 movies, 10,000 movies at this point in my life, kept me on edge going, wait a minute, is there a monster here? And then oddly enough, I feel the monster is within the family. there's so much of that within the characters and the stuff. Some of the stuff that the characters are saying, I'm like, Jesus. These people are horrible. Like, they're so mean. And I'm like, that's my family. I know that. I got that person in my family. I got that person in my family. I got that person in my family. They would say something like that. So it's like this, it was just such a, the thing I love about it, and then I'll ask you another question, but the thing I love about it is that on face level, it didn't seem like I was going to be a good story. I knew it was going to be well written and all of that, but when you first, the first few frames, you're just like, this is, I didn't expect what I expected. And that's so rare in today's world that you walk in thinking something and you walk out thinking something else. And it's so hard to do that nowadays because we're so jaded and so literate visually and seeing so many things for us to be surprised at anything. And it wasn't a cheap surprise. It wasn't like the cat jumped out at you. It was just done on a psychological level. May I say almost Kubrickian. In the way that it gets under your skin a bit, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I don't even know that I want to say anything other than it's a real joy to just listen to somebody, you know, process the film. It's a private experience for so long. You sort of make it and you hope you long for the opportunity to hear what other people think and experience. And from the voyeurism. I mean, it's interesting. It's such a slow burn, and the movie, in a way that I was really hoping or couldn't really anticipate, was how many people like you kind of come in cold, in a way that the dream was that there would be need to be no preparation, that this wasn't the type of adaptation that was like, you loved the play, now come and see the movie, that it was really its own entity. And so the surprise element, which I guess I'm most proud of, because it feels like it's born out of the emotion of the ride of the story, the characters and their journey. That sort of bending a really familiar thing that we all know, but so slowly, while also not being dishonest. It's from the opening frames. Everything, the DNA of what I'm doing is embedded in the shots. I mean, it's a very bizarre opening shot of a dad to be hiding behind like the molding in a distance, like you said. So part of you knows. And yet I also wanted the audience, because none of it needs to be processed, you know, consciously, which is part of like, you know, watching Kubrick. It's like, you don't even know what some of those images and the frame is doing to you or what the focus, but you just know that you're feeling unsettled. And so I was actually blown away by using domestic drama and comedy, how it's such a familiar thing, right? It's in our bones. We know what the family have in Thanksgiving. We know what these movies do. We know what they do and we love them for it. And so I was surprised how just shooting them differently, I mean, literally working with my cinematographer and just framing them in unfamiliar ways.
Right.
How much power that has, almost because it doesn't announce itself. It doesn't that, like, you know, you noticed it. You were like, okay, he's keeping his distance. This is a lot of empty space here for
people. Yeah.
But to an audience who's just going to watch a movie, you sort of like, the slow burn of it, as you sort of, the movie teaches you how to watch it, I think if you forget it more, and you almost don't know where the dread or the creeping suspicion that something's off. I don't even want to say dread, but like by just the power of cinema, of just the visual imagery of just image by image, is that you can hold familiar things
right
a little askew. You can go down a tenement hallway, you know, on the right focal length, and you're just like, why am I scared watching Amy Schumer walk down a hallway? Like, this is not this is not a weird moment. I just laughed at her and June Squibb, like, what's happening? And you know, last night, like, the Paramount's so great because it's such a large space.
It's huge.
And it went from a laugh line about, you know, Amy's like, do you want me to just dump grandma down the staircase? How am I supposed to go down there? To just cutting to the next shot of this red, this like blood red.
Yes, with that lovely hallway. With that lovely image on the elevator.
With the lovely image on the elevator. But like the audience, and this is something that's like now I'm just getting experience for the first time, just kind of went, oh, like they felt something about that was eerie to the point that there was like the way that one does in a horror movie where you just instinctively know it's like too claustrophobic. You want June Squibb to have more room in her wheelchair. And I just love that. I mean, that's the power of like a photograph and of like the moving picture. It's like the just how powerful the frame is. And I think for me, it was always a balance of not to lean too much into, mm-hmm. like, I think the things I love about the genre are what I hate about it. And that I hate being told so early on that a scary thing is coming, like right. with music, like with The Sting. And I still love it because it's like, oh, a scary thing's about to happen. And then it happens, but it's still satisfying. And but The Humans is kind of playing with all the tropes that I love, like, wrapping my arms around them, but also like, what if it's also like a horror movie with jump scares, but also much quieter? What if it doesn't have the lead in underscoring of a horror movie, like the thing right. that telegraphs like creepy, creepy. And weirdly for the movie like this, I think it makes it feel a little like
creepier.
More creepy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Like, there
yeah.
should be, someone should be telling me more how to feel. Like someone should be holding my hand as an audience member. Because we're so used to that, like, this is a scary scene or this is a funny scene.
You know, you definitely leave the audience out there. You're guiding them, but you leave them out there. You're like you said, you're not guiding them. So yeah. they're kind of just like, I have nothing to hold on to. I like, what's going on? And it gets worse in the best way possible as the film goes on. As you build it, you just start like, I can't hold on to the sting. I can't hold on to the score. There's no monster, like, and you're just like, but I don't, so you're off kilter completely. And it's so brilliant. That scene in the hallway, I mean, you're using blood red as the door, the cover of the elevator. So I'm like, and all the other stuff. So I can understand why people felt like a little bit off there. But, you know, going back to what we were talking about with Kubrick, I mean, I was trying to explain to my wife, who's never seen The Shining before. She's like, is it a scary movie? And I go, it's not as much that it's scary, is that it gets in your bones. And it's that, it's not like there's a couple of scary images in it, but it's not really it's not a horror movie in the grand scope. And it has that kind of just eeriness, the way things are framed, the way things are sitting there. And there were touches of that in The Humans, which was so beautiful because you just like, I just feel weird here. I don't know why. And it just gets you, it gets inside you. And that is not that's not superficial like a lot of horror movies are, or a lot of cinema is a lot of times. It's always on the front. But when you can get inside someone's psyche or in their bones, you've achieved something. No question.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's a challenge. It is really hard. And you never know, you know, what works for one person might not work for another right. person who, right. you know, I respect everybody's opinions and taste. And so I also don't, you know, I don't think somebody's wrong if their adrenaline only gets fueled by like, you know, quick cuts. And I think, you know, we are who we are. And so, I sort of share that love of the like, you know, why can't I stop thinking about, you know, The Tenet? It's like these movies that feel deeply imperfect, or why can't I stop thinking about The Shining? Why does the imagery still to this day, you know, more than a movie that might be so hell-bent on exploiting the why just dump blood in the hallway? That's not scary. What if we see, shouldn't we be seeing people split open that spills the blood into the, you know, so even the people come away from The Shining thinking of it as like the ultimate like gory movie. It's almost like you have to see it again to really remember that like intestines, the movie's not about like intestines being thrown and eaten at every turn. It's almost like, I agree with you that it's more shocking how much it is about like the architecture and the framing. And the fun thing about like Making the Humans was going down the wormhole of like pre-war architecture and empty space. And, you know, there's been a lot of like interesting writing about like the horrors of empty space and that in empty, the more empty the frame, the more horror is implied. But it's also a lot to like take the leap to hope that, you know, because I think other people understandably are just like, fill the frame. Like, don't make me be patient. And like what you said was the goal, but also a lot of people, in a way that I understand, as somebody who likes to watch like a good rom-com every now and then, like I literally will tune in those moments to watch a movie when I want the handholding, or I want a movie or a TV show that's going to tell me what it is at every turn. I don't want to have to be like, what's going on? Why am I feeling this? Yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then, of course, my favorite movies are movies that you know, take that journey and take that risk and feel like complicated people. Like, you know, my favorite movies have this, they feel like people to me, like in the same way that my favorite people on the planet are not all good or all bad. They're complicated, but they're specific, but they're like so specific. Mm-hmm. And so you can revisit them again and again and again and again, because they never really bore you, or there's something that just feels authentic about the fact that they're sprung from like a vision instead of like my biggest fear, which is like movies made by committee, you know, where you almost, or too many, you know what I mean? I'm not talking about collaborations, like where people choose to work in teams. I'm talking more about like, you know, four writers got fired, three other writers got brought on, then 17 more writers came out of the project, then 54 more uncredited writers got brought on, and then, you know, and then three producers re-edited the movie after it got taken away from the director, and maybe 3 years from now we'll see the cut. And so, yeah, there's the beauty in A24 in that they've essentially found success in movies that are those movies, or let's just say they're not phased by slightly genre bending or hard to pin down. So I also feel like I had like the right home to do the those kinds of things that you're talking about.
Now, you know, the Humans is originally a play, and that play won a Tony Award. I gotta ask, man, what was it like winning a Tony Award?
Winning the award. I mean, it's great. It's also like the big gift of like awards is that they don't, it's not that they don't mean a lot. They do in that it's like, it, you know, it's like a, you know, it's affirmation. It's a nice thing. It almost like the real gift of like getting the golden ticket, like in a moment like that, is that it also shines a light on how the real like joy, gifts, everything about what you do, it really just comes from like, are you making stuff that you feel like, how do you feel about what you're doing?
Right.
And no external, you know, and so the moment you get it or you get the brass ring, I'd say it kind of just confirmed like why I was staying on my day job to write the plays that I was writing, why, you know, I never took like more commercial screenwriting options that I just didn't want to. I think there's nothing wrong with taking them, but just I didn't feel like drawn to the specific projects or in other words, I just think it's not that it's a piece of hardware, it has meaning, it's just that it also sort of reminds you that the looking to other people to give you a trophy is not where it's at. It's kind of like it's a great lesson to learn. And I think I had that crazy good fortune that come my way, you know, in my mid-30s, which is great that it didn't happen to me when I was 22.
Oh God.
I might have thought that it didn't mean something it didn't.
Yep.
But that I actually am fancy. And instead, it was just a season, like, incredible. I mean, what's fascinating is it was up against The Father, which mm-hmm. became a movie last year, the one with Anthony Hopkins and yeah. Olivia Colman. So there's, like, two – it's fun to see, like, there's often long droughts of, like, plays that become movies, and it's funny to see in one season, like, that we both got our movies made, and he did such a brilliant job. But just to say, I mean, I don't know, does that answer your question?
No, it does. No, it does. And it's because I've had Oscar winners. I've had any winners on the show. I've talked to, and I always like to ask that question because I'd like to see, because so many people listening think that's the end goal. And I always tell, like, when you win the Oscar, you've got maybe a 3 minute, 4 to 5 minute situation. You don't even remember it when you're up there, is from what I understand. And then, you're whisked away, you do a bunch of press, and then it just starts to wean away. But I've talked to so many people who've won those awards who afterwards were depressed because they're like, where now? Where do I go now? Because they associated so much to those awards, as opposed to, no, what you need to associate is the journey. Have fun in the journey, because that's a lot longer than that 1 minute.
And it's also, it's just, you know, going back to, like, the staying connected to work that comes from your gut and your heart, or just that you're obsessed with. I don't mm-hmm. even have to make it like a Hallmark card, you know, the joy that comes from being, like, obsessed with what you're making, you know, it feels very childlike and very cliched, but it's like, nothing is better than that. And then taking the journey to try to make something that has meaning to you, that you want to share and make with others. It's just where it's at. And the, everything else is a red herring. it's just a red herring. It's just like dangling. It's like, what are all these sci-fi movies? I feel like it's like, I just watched Lynch's Dune again, and it's like the spice. It's like, you know, it feels like it's the spice. It's like a hallucinogen. It's,
yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like one of those movies where you spend the whole, like, looking for the golden snicket or one of those things. And it's, and then you know, it's so cliched, but it's like, And you know, I experienced this with, I have incredibly brilliant students, and I'm so impressed with everybody that I get the chance to work with every year. And I'm just like, you have to, like, leave room for how hard it is to, that their fears about, like, the focus is like, I want an agent and I want to get this. Oh, I want to get in at these.
Yeah.
They're thinking about all the wrong things, but, you know, you also remember the hunger and how those things do feel important, because before, until you have some validation, you feel like that's what's going to make you a writer. That's what's going to make you a director. And it's like, I do tell them that, but it's funny to see, you know, to make space for, like, the feelings on both sides. But the best gift of it is, it just, for, in my case, it sort of refocused me to not, just to see for what it is, like a great sort of, feels like a slice of birthday cake, and just nice. Like a delicious piece of birthday cake. You eat it, had too much icing on it. You end up feeling a little like, should I have eaten that piece of cake? But it was delicious. You don't regret it. And then, you know, the next day it's gone. And so you're just, I'd say the big thing that's, is true about awards, which is hard to admit, because it feels, as somebody who, you know, doesn't have a publicist and is not going to chase them.
Yeah.
They do get more people to see your work. And so I would say, like, it would be a lie to say that if, you know, you win the Tony Award for Best Play or you win Academy Award for Best Picture, you know, the thing that, if someone were to say, like, do they have any value? My answer is no, in terms of personal value, but yes, they do, in terms
marketing.
Of more eyeballs.
Yeah. And marketing and seeing, branding, everything. Although, yeah, absolutely. No question.
So there's, to me, there's a bit of a sadness in that. Like, I hate the focus that gets put on awards. And, I also hate that these things that I don't think have truth beneath them, or literally mean that you wrote the best play of the, like, in a godlike way, I hate that they do really result in, you know, and being cinephiles, like, we all have those screenplays and movies we're obsessed with where, you know, almost everybody's favorite movie got ripped off or snubbed.
I mean, Shawshank Redemption.
Shawshank Redemption, or I was just saying, I read some crazy article where someone was like, will this be Paul Thomas Anderson's year where like he finally gets recognized? I was like, Paul Thomas Anderson hasn't been recognized by the Academy?
I know, you read my mind. I'm like, wait a minute, did he not get like an Oscar for a script?
He must never have been gotten the golden ticket or something.
Neither did Kubrick. Neither did Kubrick.
But of course, that doesn't matter. It's like his. So you know, or someone like even you know, Stanley Kubrick. It's like, we know these things. It's like they're totally true. And then
sure.
You know, I'd say that just so I don't sound completely like Guy Smiley. I'd say the complex thing is that they really can help a movie's. Get seen by more
absolutely.
People. And, you know, as writers and directors, like, of course, it feels like a lie to not say, like, that is part of the dream is that people also see your work, especially in the independent film market. It does feel like it's just so hard to get.
Right.
Especially in this landscape, how do you, when you can't do platform releases anymore, like, what does it mean for these movies to just get blasted to very quickly to 1,300 screens? And then to VOD and
right. You want to get people to watch it. You want to get people to watch it. I have to ask you. So I've talked to so many screenwriters and filmmakers in general that they talk about the zone and tapping into that place, that creative place where you can, you know, whatever comes, I always consider myself a conduit. I think many of the people I've spoken to are writers specifically. They're like, I don't write this. I'm here and it comes to me and it just comes right through me. But there's certain people that know how to go there and tap into that all the time. What is your process to kind of center yourself to get to that place where these ideas flow in and you can just like Tarantino says it so beautifully. He's like, I'm not writing this. I'm just a dictator. I'm just a stenographer on these guys talking, you know, and he gets into that place. And there's so many people who know screenwriters who know how to do that almost on demand, but it's rare. How do you do it? How do you do it in your work?
I don't rush it. So I'm not the person to hire if you need like a very quick,
a quick 2 week, job. two, 3 week turnaround.
I become obsessive and I let myself, I'll tell you what I do. I like with this film, I very much felt haunted by, Ali Farid's The Soul, a Fassbender film, because of the way it held its middle-aged female character in this pre-war architecture, a lot of frames within frames, like you mentioned. Kieslowski being very in the three colors, like being very close, very distant. And so I had this concept of like running with that and being something felt very right about not filming it traditionally, being very close or very wide and not a lot of in between. And so I let myself like I do research trips a lot before I write. So to your point about the zone, I don't force it. I'm not the person that's still at 7 a.m. writing 10 pages of a screenplay. If I'm feeling stuck and a little blocked, I will go back to a really like visual place, especially. That tends to get me excited and it gets me more in the zone. And it just gets me thinking in a way that is more filmic and more dimensional. And, you know, I watched Yi by Edward Yang like 100 times. And it's just a movie. I mean, I found it years ago because it was on some obscure, like, thank you, Martin Scorsese. It was like on one of his like top 10 movies of the 2000s. And I was like, what's this movie? But it's filmed very wide. It's also people spill very like Ozu's people spilling in and out of the frame, the very patient. And so I kind of just let myself, when I'm not in the writing zone, like go into a watching zone and watching other people's work and feeling, doing a lot of reading. And usually that points me back to the writing, like back to where I'm ready to open final draft and get going again. But I don't have the practice of like pushing through 5 screenplay pages every day. I don't think that's a bad practice. I just, you know,
not for you.
You know, part of creative is also figuring out what your own craziness and process is. And for me, I do really get sort of like fuel from, more dimensional thinking, and that often involves reading, visual art, and watching movies. So.
Now, what advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
It's a great question. I would say the core thing that has never sort of altered is just focusing on work that comes from your gut level place. Making movies or coming, whatever you're creating, a short film, play, feature, keep the focus on the kind of movie that only you could make, and stop looking to these external guides or, wow, that did really well at that film festival, or that was a big hit last year. And you can play that game, and you can probably do it even really well. I mean, I think a lot of people probably do. I just feel like my advice would be, I've gotten the most traction, success, personal happiness on the journey in making these things by focusing, just, yeah, being reminded that the largest thing you can make is often the thing that's already inside you, like the kind of thing that the qualities and quirks and the sense of humor and the weird sense of everything about yourself is that you actually have. It's so freeing to me, as opposed to thinking like, I got to make this movie more important with a capital I by writing about someone else's family. Or, right, I know she'll be pregnant. Like, suddenly you start drawing from these ideas that are so external. And I think it's much more frightening and hard to remind, like, especially young writers, how if you actually accept that the biggest ideas are already somehow like locked inside of you, it's kind of like, it's almost scarier, because it's a nice like scapegoat to be like, what will my next film be? It should be something like that, or a war movie, or big. It feels very abstract, because you're drawing on influence in the wrong way, instead of like knowing from a gut level, like, I want to write about my mom, or I want to write this comedy. I want to make myself laugh. Like, doing something that feels, no matter how abstracted it becomes, right? Like, but when you're anchored in that, I just feel like you never go wrong. Even when you're screwing up and you have to, and you are failing, and you have to try to figure out what the structure is that'll hold that gut level idea. It's just the only way that I think I know you go wrong in a million ways is when you start from the other place. Like, wow, it seems like these things are doing really well. Or
no,
I guess I should write a horror movie.
No, it's always,
and then it comes from the wrong place. No matter how talented you are, it comes, it never sort of, yeah, the journey is never as rich.
I always tell people that the only thing that you have that makes you different in the marketplace is your own secret sauce. It's that thing inside you that nobody else has. And I was talking, not to drop a name, but David Chase, who is the creator of The Sopranos, of course, and he wanted to write a movie about his mom. his and that's how The Sopranos was brought into the world. You know, he wasn't going, you know what's big now? Superheroes. Like, he didn't say that. So it was that. And what,
or like somebody that he's influenced being like, not knowing, the people never know that the deep personal connections, even creators who write mob movies or series of it. That, and so the hilarity is, so many young writers try to imitate The Sopranos and create something that they think is about crime, guns, and they think that's what's underscoring The Sopranos, which isn't the reason Sopranos is so unbelievable is it's all the emotional undercurrent that clearly, like, David's connection to these characters is the undergirding. You think it's the action and that's delicious, but that's the secret sauce is not the guns and the murder. It's that part of, yeah. I mean, I didn't know that he said that. That's amazing. Yeah. And I also want to steal the secret sauce, because it'll save me a lot of, I feel like my answer is so long-winded. And I'm like, it's about the secret sauce.
It's about the secret sauce. It's the only thing that you have. Like, it's only the only thing, your life experience, your interests, your things, like you, like things that I couldn't write. The humans. No one could write the humans. Only you can write the humans. And you couldn't write, you know, The Sopranos, because only David could write The Sopranos. And that's the thing, is you got to find that thing with inside you. That's so brilliant.
Do you feel the struggle yourself, though, like how easy it is? I guess the counter to this should be, like, it is really easy to get away from, like, it can be hard to keep reminding yourself, like, when you're getting away from that place.
I'll tell you what. I chased the dragon. I call it chasing the dragon. I chased that dragon so much. Like, oh, that's hot. Or I'm going to be like that director. I'm going to write like this person. And I did that for so many years till I finally, I guess, and this only happens as you get older. You just said, nope, I need to focus on what's inside me. And the second I started doing that, my work got better. Doors opened up. You know, things just started to lay themselves out at me where I didn't have to work as hard to get certain things. Whereas when I was trying to chase the dragon, all there was is block, 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 block. Oh, you're almost there. Nope. Take it away. Block, block. Almost there again. Oh, nope. Block. And it was just so fascinating to like, and only when you finally, I guess when you're comfortable enough in your own skin, and it takes a minute for you to do that in life. You know, some guys have it in their 20s. Some guys and gals have it in their 20s. I didn't. Like you said, when you got your success was in the mid 30s, and thank God it was, because you probably would have lost your mind in your 20s, and I would have lost my mind in the 20s.
Sure, I would have lost my mind.
Yeah, of course. And we would have probably self-destructed because we weren't prepared for that. One person, a friend of mine, an actor, said this, a great comment. And he's like, when your fame is like a bucket of water. And when you're young, you're a seedling, and inside the bucket, there's a seed, and the water comes in and just swashes you all over the damn place. But when you get older, the roots take place. And then when the water comes in, you don't move as much.
That's awesome.
Isn't that amazing?
Wait, who do you credit that to?
Is
that a friend of yours?
That is Carlos Arozraki from Reno 911. And he was playing a character in my first feature, and his character was like a guru, and he just splurted that out. And I'm like, Carlos, I know you're trying to make fun of the guru, but that was damn good. And I quote that quote all the time because I'm like, that's an amazing – I don't know if he got it from somewhere else or not, but that's where I heard it from. So shout out to Carlos Arozraki from Reno 911.
The illusion and what I see with younger writers a lot too is that what's very funny is like the first taste of any kind of success, mm-hmm. people – you're then – the way to – there's this illusion that the way to capitalize on it is that the opportunity that comes your way is often like people seeing your special sauce and then trying to weirdly like capture your special sauce, but then add their own ingredients to it because maybe they want you to staff write for a show where special sauce then easily get drowned out. And I think that's a hard lesson to learn for a lot of younger writers too, because who can fault anyone for wanting a good paycheck and I went through one process. I mean, I have not written a ton of screenplays. I've written two before this. Both got made. One, I saw a third of it got rewritten. A gay character got turned straight, you know. But it was – even in those things, they're valuable lessons in terms of even like now going forward. It's like, well, what – if I ever do write a play that I think could be a film, you know, the play before this, Sons of the Prophet, I was happy to just let it not become a movie, because you have to sort of live through these things. And once you live through the fact that like a little bit of extra money doesn't actually make you happy, like if you're waking up mm-hmm. and working on something that you,
yes,
that's causing you a lot of stress. And I'd fall asleep at night going like, no, there should be two gay people in this movie. Why is there, why is one of them now straight? It's not going to be more commercial. It's going to be a disaster. You know, it's like, okay, well you have to, when you're in your 20s, you have to learn that lesson before you really feel the truth of it. Because in your 20s, after like, you know, a day job for 10 years, I was like, I think maybe this security and this money for a year will make me exclusively happy in a way that I am underestimating. And then I had it and I was like, oh yeah, I forgot. Like, I don't like buying a lot of clothes anyway. Like, I don't. I do want to be able to pay my rent.
Once you have your same four
shirts every day, like every week anyway. Yeah. And so this didn't feel fancy in the way that I thought it would feel fancy. And I do think some lessons have to be learned. I mean, I guess it's like,
it's not easy.
But I love talking advice like with you, and it's like how to find that sweet spot of like not forgetting that like you arrived with a certain degree of knowledge. But by needing to learn some of it viscerally instead of like thinking that like, yeah, if I was 22 and someone gave me this talk, I would just believe them and would just,
oh no. You know. If someone gave me this talk at 22, I would have said, you're, yeah, whatever. I know everything. You know nothing. I'm serious. No, that's the way, you know it. That's the way it was when we were 22. It's just like, you look at someone would have had this conversation. They could have given us the keys to the universe, literally. And they're like, if it could have been me from the future coming back, talking to my younger self. And I would go, dude, I've gone through this. Don't do this. Don't do this. Do this. Do this. Invest in Apple at $7 and everything is going to be fine.
Also Roth IRA. Where was the guy? Someone should have given me that lecture. If you don't have parents that know how to save for money, you got to Google it.
Absolutely.
Start your own Roth. You just got to do it.
And last question, sir, because I have to ask this question. Three of your favorite films of all time.
I feel like I kind of gave them away in The Making of the Human. So it's like I've listed three films, but that Ollie Fury, The Soul. Mm-hmm. Incredible love story. Incredible drama, incredible everything about it. I love striking movie in every sense of the word, and completely surprising. I guess this is three movies, but the Three Colors trilogy. I picked one of them.
They're the best.
Three Colors,
I love.
But
Double Life of Veronique. Oh,
Double Life of Veronique. So I guess I could be giving away. I guess that is three movies. Edward Yang is a favorite as well. And I feel like there's so much in the horror genre and psychological thrillers that it's hard to be asked this question, because the truth is I just want to sit and just keep hearing yours. And then I want to say three back. And then I want you to say three more. And then I want to go, oh, yeah. Because even in with the Stanley Kubrick, it's like how to not, like 2001, like I still remember like actual feelings I had. Mm-hmm. When watching something, even the first time when I didn't understand it, I just remember like feeling like things, worlds expanding. Like because I didn't grow up with going to like some sort of sophisticated, arts camp or something, or I felt like I was in college really sorting this out in my 20s before I was even exposed to a lot of, incredible, filmmakers and auteurs. But Stanley is one of those people who like 2001 weirdly slipped its way into my like blockbuster experience in mm-hmm. in high school. And I just do remember like just a kind of like understanding something you don't even understand, that there's a whole way to reveal yourself and other worlds through art that is just like beyond what you even thought was possible.
It's
because I didn't think people were allowed to do things like
not at that level. Not at that level. Not with that
not
budget.
At that level.
Not with that
not
budget.
With that.
Not with that budget, my friend.
But basically, I guess what I'm saying is like this game is only fun for me if it's this just 45 minutes of us talking about, because I don't actually have, in the same way that I think awards are bogus, I don't really believe in favorite films. I just believe in like the 170 movies that I'm most
right, exactly. And I feel like this conversation is something that you would have heard at 3 o'clock in the morning at a Denny's after watching a midnight showing of a Kubrick film. I feel this is what this conversation would be like. And you're laughing. If everyone not listening, this, you're laughing.
I don't want to just go with you, get the Grand Slam special, and just go have that conversation.
It's exactly what the.
I'm laughing. I'm like, that is exactly what. That takes me back to Scranton, and I do want the moon's over Miami. Do you remember that?
Of course, I remember that. And you
that's
and you would.
Place.
Hey. Oh God, it was a happy
so
place.
Like, yeah, I'll go to the midnight. Let's find the next midnight screening. I'll meet you there.
Oh my God.
And now we can Zoom at Denny's, so we'd have no excuse.
Oh my
so
God, that's amazing.
That be our next interview.
Steven, man, thank you again. First of all, where can people see the movie?
So we're going to open in, I don't know how public this is yet, but we're going to be in about 20 cities on November 24th.
Okay.
Anywhere you can Google and find out which art house cinema is playing your new movies is that will be revealed very soon. But November 24th, day before Thanksgiving, in theaters, and then rolling out largely slowly after that. But
that's awesome.
20 markets starting November 24th.
I am so glad. The powers that be gave you the keys to the car so you can drive this thing. And I'm so glad that they gave it to you. And I hope you continue to get the keys and you continue to make amazing films, because I want to see what else you come up with, my friend. So thank you again so much for being on the show, and keep making great movies, man.
Hey, same to you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to thank Steven so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Steven. If you want to get links to anything we talk about in this episode, including how to watch his new film, The Humans, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/523. And by the way, guys, for all my listeners in America, happy Thanksgiving. May you have a fantastic dinner and celebration with your family and friends. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.